Doug Hammarskjöld, that UN, former UN Secretary General, puts it so beautifully. God does not die, he says, the day we deny his existence, but we die on the day that our lives cease to be illumined by the radiance of a wonder which we can never describe, which is quite beyond us. We die the day our lives cease to be illumined by that radiance, that wonder. And we don't have to quarrel about a word, because God is only a word, is it not? God is only a concept. One never quarrels about reality. We only quarrel about opinions, about concepts, about judgments. Don't seek for truth. Only drop your concepts. Drop your opinions. Drop your prejudices. Drop your judgments. And you will see. You know, that was philosophy. That was metaphysics. How do you like it? Not bad, huh? Well, I think that will be the toughest session of all the ones we've had. Thought I'd bring you this little quote from St. Thomas. How about giving it to you in Latin? For quia de Deo scire non possumus quid sit, sed quid non sit, non possumus considerare de Deo quomodo sit, sed quomodo non sit. This is the introduction to his whole Summa Theologica. Since we do not know what God is, but what God is not, we cannot tell you God's way of being, but rather the way he is not. Then I gave you his De Trinitate. The loftiest degree of our knowledge of God is to know God as the unknown, tam quam ignotum. And in his Questio Disputata de Potentia Dei 7, he says, this is what is ultimate in the human knowledge of God, to know that we do not know God. This is what is ultimate in the human knowledge of God, to know that we do not know God. This gentleman was considered the prince of theologians, as I told you yesterday. He was certainly acquainted with the scriptures. He was a mystic and a canonized saint. We're standing on pretty good ground. Then what was he talking about when he talked about God? And what is the meaning of the scriptures? More about that later. See, I keep you coming that way. In India, we have a Sanskrit saying for this kind of thing. It is neti neti. Not that. Not that. Sometimes referred to as the via negativa. Negative way. You know, I read a marvelous work by the famous C.S. Lewis. It's a little booklet, A Grief Observed. It was his diary. When his wife died, he married an American woman, said to his friends, God gave me in my 60s what he denied me in my 20s. I'm wildly in love. Fell in love with this woman, married her, and he had hardly married her when she died a painful death of cancer. Then C.S. Lewis says, the whole of my faith crumbled like a house of cards. He was the great Christian apologist. And when disaster struck home, then he asks himself, is God a loving father, or is he the great vivisector? Pretty good evidence for both things. And you can look at things in a somewhat slanted way and push aside evidence of the contrary. Remember when my own mother got cancer, my sister said to me, Tony, why did God allow this to happen to mother? I said, my dear, last year 1 million people died in China of starvation, of a drought, calculated at almost 1 million. You never raise the question. And so sometimes the nicest thing that could happen to us, for us to be awakened to reality, is for calamity to strike. Then we begin to rethink. Then you might lose your belief and come to faith, your childish belief and come to faith, as C.S. Lewis did. Do read that book. It's marvelously written. He said, you know, I never had any doubt before about people surviving death. But when my wife died, my, I was no longer certain. Why? Because it was so important to me that she be living. And, you know, he's the master of comparisons and analogies. He says it's like a rope. Someone says to you, would this carry a, would this bear the weight of about 120 pounds? And you say, yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to let down your best friend on this rope. You say, wait a minute, let me test that again. Now you're not so sure. And somewhere in that diary, he says a marvelous thing. I was so happy and consoled, this was years ago, to find him say, we know nothing about God. We cannot know anything about God. Even our very questions about God are absurd. Marvelous. Of course your questions are absurd. Why? It's like the person born blind, the man born blind, who says to you, that color green, is it hot or is it cold? Natty, natty, not that, not that. Is it long or is it short? Not that. Is it sweet or is it sour? Not that. Is it round or is it oval or is it square? Not that, not that. See, he's coming from the other senses, from his limited experience. He has no words, or no concepts for this world of which he has no idea, no intuition, no experience, the world of colors. One can only speak in analogies. Not that. No matter what he asks, it isn't that. Your wording is wrong. Your question is absurd. So, C.S. Lewis says something like this. I'm not quite sure I've got the exact words, but it's something like this. It's like asking, how many minutes are there in the color yellow? And everybody's taking it very seriously and discussing it and fighting about it. You know what the answer to that question is? How many minutes are there in the color yellow? 25 carrots. And the other guy says, no, 17 potatoes. And then they're fighting. Not that. Not that. The ultimate. This is what is ultimate in the human knowledge of God, to know that we do not know. Our great tragedy, my dears, is that we know too much. We think we know. That is our tragedy. So we never discover. In fact, Thomas Aquinas is not only a theologian, he's a great philosopher. And he says repeatedly in many places, all the efforts of the human mind cannot exhaust the essence of a single fly. Cannot. We really have no notion of the nature of a fly, of an individual fly. Just what I was telling you yesterday. The concept is abstract, the reality concrete, etc. He puts it in his own unique way. The limitations of the human mind. The danger we have of equating the concept with reality and as a result, never coming in touch with reality. Now, I also quoted Dag Hammarskjöld. You know, I like to be exact, and I'm afraid the quote I gave you was from memory and wasn't quite accurate. The original is much more beautiful. He says, God does not die on the day we cease to believe in a personal deity. But we die on the day when our lives cease to be illumined by the steady radiance renewed daily of a wonder, the source of which is beyond all reason. But we die on the day when our lives cease to be illumined by the steady radiance renewed daily of a wonder, the source of which is beyond all reason. Something beyond this conceptualizing mind of ours, which, when perceived, intuited, however dimly, creates the wonder, and our lives become illumined. Marvelously put. But more about this when I talk about Scripture. I want to say something more about words. I said to you yesterday, words are limited. There's something more I have to add. There are some words that correspond to nothing. Words that have a very powerful influence on us. You know, when I use the word tree, it corresponds to something. When I say man or woman or child, that corresponds to something. But there are some words that correspond to nothing. Would you believe it? For instance, talking of a situation back home, I'm an Indian. Now, we've got another country called Pakistan. Now, let's suppose I am a prisoner of war in Pakistan. And they say to me, well, today we're going to take you to the frontier and you're going to take a look at your country. And so they bring me to the frontier. And I look across the border and I think, oh, my country, my beautiful country. I see villages and trees and hills. Like that thing of the poet, breathes there a man with soul so dead, who never to himself has said, my, you got it, yes. This is my own, my native land. And after a while, one of the guards says, excuse me, we made a mistake, sir. We have to move on another 10 miles. You know, it's fun. What was I reacting to? Indian trees, Indian villages, Indian mountains. But you know something? Trees are not Indian. Trees are trees. There are no Indian trees. In a geographical map, there are no frontiers, no boundaries. Those were put there by the human mind, generally by stupid, avaricious politicians. That country of mine, once upon a time, was one. It's four now. And if we don't look out, within a short time, it might be six. We'll have six flags. We'll have six armies. You never catch me saluting a flag. Me, never. Any flag, never saluted. I abhor all national flags. I do. You go ahead. What are we saluting? I salute humanity. Not a flag with an army around it. Now, of course, I live in a peculiar situation where I see flags coming up. These flags were in the heads of people. They're fighting for a convention. They're fighting for a frontier, which the human mind put there, but doesn't exist in reality. Now, I got news for you. There are thousands of words in our vocabulary that do not correspond to reality at all. But boy, they trigger emotions. They trigger off emotions within us. And we begin to see things which are not there. We actually see Indian mountains, but they don't exist. And we actually see Indian people, what do you know, they don't exist. They really don't. Oh, well, you know, you have your American conditioning. I have my American conditioning. That exists. Not a very happy thing. You know, in our countries nowadays, in the third world countries, we talk a great deal about inculturation. Culture. this thing called culture. Not very happy with it. Me, not very happy with it. Because part of our liberation is liberation from our culture. You mean you'd like to do something because you were conditioned to do it? You'd like to feel something because you were conditioned to feel it? Isn't that being mechanical? You got a stamp on you and you react according to that stamp? Imagine an American baby that is adopted by a Russian couple, taken over to Russia, has no notion that it was born American. Because there is no such thing as American. So he's brought up talking Russian. He lives and dies for Mother Russia. He hates the Americans. He's all stamped with his own culture. He's steeped in his own literature. He's influenced and he looks at the world through the eyes of his culture. You want to wear your cultures the way you wear clothes, that's fine. You know, it's nice. The woman, Indian woman will wear a sari, and the American woman will wear something else, and the Chinese woman will wear something else, and the Japanese woman will wear her kimono. That's nice. But nobody's identifying herself with the clothes. So you want to wear culture like that? That's nice. But then you become proud of your culture. They teach you to be proud of it. They teach you to be proud of your country. There are emotions. Words that are emotionally charged. Nobody sits down and analyzes that. Remember how I told you, if you are affected or influenced by an experience you had with your father, let me put it as forcefully as possible. There's this Jesuit friend of mine who says, anytime I see a poor person, a beggar, I cannot give this person an alms. I cannot not give this person an alms. I got that from my mother, he says. My mother, ever since I was a kid, you know, he lived somewhere in the countryside in India, and any poor person who'd come there, well, his mother'd offer that person a meal, etc. He said, I picked it up from her. I said to him, Joe, what you have is not a virtue. What you have is a compulsion. A good one, from the point of view of the beggar, but a compulsion nonetheless. You cannot not do this. I remember a Jesuit who said to us once at a province meet, a kind of an intimate gathering of the men of our Jesuit province there in Bombay. Very nice to hear that. He said, I am 80 years old. I've been a Jesuit for 65 years. I have never once in all my life missed my hour of morning meditation. Never once. Nice. Could be very admirable, or it could be a compulsion too. No great merit in that, if it's mechanical. The beauty of an action comes not from its having become a habit, but from sensitivity, from consciousness, from clarity of perception and accuracy of response. I may say yes to this beggar, I may say no to another. I'm not compelled by any conditioning, programming of my past experiences or my culture. Nobody has stamped anything on me, or if they have, I'm no longer reacting from that. It's like you have a bad experience with an American, or you were bitten by a dog, or you had a bad experience with a certain kind of food. Now, for the rest of your life, you're influenced by that experience. Too bad. You need to be liberated from that. Don't carry over experiences from the past. Hey, I see many of you nodding in assent. How about carrying over good experiences from the past? Huh? Don't carry those either. You know what it means? To experience something fully, then drop it, and move on to the next moment, uninfluenced by the previous one? My, you're traveling with such little baggage, you could pass through the eye of a needle. Now you will know what eternal life is. Because eternal life is now. In the timeless now. Only thus will you enter eternal life. That's how many things we carry with us. And we never set about the task of freeing ourselves, of dropping the baggage, of being ourselves. And I'm so sorry to say that everywhere I go, I find Muslims who are using their religion and their worship and their Quran to distract themselves from this task. Instead of serving as a help, serves as a distraction. And the same applies to Hindus and you know who else. Now you're very clever, you're catching on quickly today. Now, words, they have such an influence on us. You know, you're talking to somebody, listen to this. You're talking to somebody, he seems a nice kind of guy, and somebody whispers into your ear, Cardinal Archbishop. Whoop! It has an influence on your mind and on your nerves. You're suddenly influenced by that, the word. See how it triggered off reactions within you? Can you imagine a human being who is no longer influenced by words, who is only affected by reality? You could give him any number of words, he'll still give you a fair deal. You could say Cardinal Archbishop, but he'll still give you a fair deal. He'll see you as you are. He's uninfluenced by the label. You could say Indian, American, Russian, Chinese, anything. He is uninfluenced by labels. So, there it is. The importance of understanding words and concepts. If we are to attain awareness, because I said to you, awareness heals, awareness transforms, awareness puts us in touch with reality. But that goes with understanding. Understanding how our mind functions and how we are being deceived by words and concepts. There's one more thing I want to say about our perception of reality. Let me put it in the form of an analogy. You've got the President of the United States. Now, he has to get feedback. Or you've got the Pope in Rome, who has to get feedback from the whole church. Now you've got millions of items that are supposed to be fed to the president, but he could hardly take all of that in, much less digest it. So he has people whom he trusts to make abstracts, to summarize things, to monitor, to filter, and then some of it gets to his desk. Now, this is what's happening to us. From every pore of our living cell of our body, and from all the senses, we're getting feedback from reality. But we're filtering things out constantly. Who's doing the filtering? Very important to find out. Your conditioning. Your culture, your programming, the way you were taught to see things and to experience things, even your language. Lots of filtering going on so that you will see things sometimes that are not there. And sometimes you don't see things that are there. That's so common. You've only got to look at a paranoid person who's feeling all threatened by something that isn't there, who's constantly interpreting reality in terms of certain experiences of the past or certain conditioning that he or she has. And there's another big crook inside there who's doing the filtering. It's called an attachment. Desire, craving. The root of sorrow is craving. Craving distorts perception. It destroys perception. You've got your fears and your desires. As Samuel Johnson said, the knowledge that he has, that he is to swing from a scaffold or that he is to be hanged within a week wonderfully concentrates a man's mind. You blot out everything else. You're concentrated only on this. Fear. Or desire. Craving. Look how we have been brought up. We were drugged when we were young. And we were brought up to need people. For what? For acceptance. For approval. For appreciation. For applause. For what they call success. Here are words that do not correspond to reality. They're conventions. Like political realities. Conventions. Things invented, but we don't realize that they don't correspond to reality. Success. What is that? That is what this particular group decided is a good thing. Another particular group will decide it's a bad thing. What is good in Washington might be considered bad in a Carthusian monastery. Success in political circles might be considered failure in other circles. These are conventions. But we treat them like realities, don't we? Now, what happened to us when we were young? We were programmed. We were taught. We were programmed to unhappiness. This is amazing. You cannot not be unhappy. Why? Because they taught you, and they taught me, they taught all of us, that in order to be happy, you need, you name it, money, success, a beautiful or handsome partner in life, a good job, friendship, spirituality, God, you name it. Unless you get these things, you're not going to be happy. You need them. Now that is what I call an attachment. An attachment is a belief that without something, you are not going to be happy. Once you get convinced of that, and my, that has got into our subconscious, it's got stamped into our nerves, to the roots of our being. But how could I be happy unless I have good health? You know, I'll tell you something. I have met people dying of cancer who are happy. But how could I be happy if I know I'm going to die? You all know of people who are happy when they are meeting death. But how could I be happy if I don't have money? You know something? This guy has got $1 million in the bank and he's feeling insecure. The other guy has got practically no money and he doesn't seem to feel any insecurity at all. He was programmed differently. That's all. Useless exhorting the first guy about what to do. He needs understanding. He needs to understand. That's where I was talking about awareness. Exhortations are no great help, as I'm going to tell you very soon. You need to understand. You've been programmed. It's a false belief. See it as false. See it as a fantasy. And so what are people doing all through their lives? They're busy fighting. Fight, fight, fight. The conflict to what they call survival. But you know, when you talk to the average American who says he or she is making a living, it isn't a living they're making. Oh no. They've got much more than enough to live. Come to my country and you'll see that. You mean you don't need all those cars to live. You really don't. You don't need a television set to live. You don't need all that makeup to live. You don't need all those clothes to live. To live, you don't need them. You really don't. But try to convince the average American of this. They've been brainwashed. They've been programmed. So conflict, work, effort, strife to get the desired object which will make them happy. Now, listen to this pathetic story. Your story, my story, everybody's story, till we understand it and break out. The story is this. They told us, until I get this object, I'm not going to be happy. Whatever it is. Money, friendship, anything. So I've got to strive to get it. And when I've got it, I've got to strive to keep it. A temporary thrill. Oh, I'm so thrilled I got it. How long does that last? A few minutes. A couple of days. At the most, when you got your brand new car, how long did the thrill last? Just as long as your next attachment was threatened. There's a funny thing about an attachment, you know. If you have 1,000 attachments, you could satisfy 999, but if you haven't satisfied one, you're miserable. So, all right, I've got it. Thrill. Now, A, get tired of it after a while. They told me prayer was the big thing. They told me God was the big thing. They told me friendship was the big thing. Not knowing what prayer really was, not knowing what God really was, we made things out of them. After a while, we get bored. Bored with the car. But we're still holding on to it. And we're still fending off threats. Isn't that pathetic? And if you've got one attachment, that's bad enough. When you have a couple of thousand, I mean, we're crazy. We're just crazy. And there's no way out. There simply is no way out. It's the only model we were given to be happy. We weren't given any other model. Our culture, our society, I'm sorry to say, even our religion, gave us no other model. This is happening in all religions too, you know. Like, you've been appointed cardinal. What a great honor that is. Honor? Did you say honor? You used the wrong word. Now others are going to aspire to it. You lapse into the world, what the Gospels call the world. And you're going to lose your soul. The world, success, honor, non-existent things, power, prestige, winning, especially over others, popularity. You gained the world, but you lost your soul. Your whole life has been empty and soulless. Nothing there. There's only one way out, and that is get deprogrammed. Get deprogrammed. How do you get that? Become aware of the programming. I'm going to be talking pretty soon about change. You cannot change by an effort of the will. You cannot change through ideals. You cannot change through building up new habits. Your behavior may change, but you don't. You only change through awareness and understanding. When you see a stone as a stone, a scrap of paper as a scrap of paper, you don't think that the stone is a precious diamond anymore, and you don't think that that scrap of paper is a check for $1 billion. When you see that, you change. There's no violence anymore in attempting to change yourself. Otherwise, what you call change is moving the furniture around. Your behavior has changed, but not you. And I'm going to give you a whole session on understanding. After the break, what does it mean to understand? How do we go about it? Attachment. You've got attachment. Consider how we're enslaved by these things. And we're striving to rearrange the world so that I can keep my attachment. Because the world is a constant threat to my attachment. Everything keeps changing. So does this thing. It's all changing. Everything is changing. So is my friend. And my God, how insecure I am. He may stop loving me. He may go out to somebody else. Hey, wait a minute. And I've got to keep on making myself attractive to him because I've got to get him because somebody brainwashed me into thinking that I need his love. I don't. I really don't. Not in order to be happy, I don't. I don't need anybody's love. I just need to get in touch with reality. That's all. I need to break out of this prison of mine, this programming, this conditioning, these false beliefs, these fantasies, and break out into reality. And reality is lovely. Reality is an absolute delight. Eternal life is now. We're surrounded by it, like the fish in the ocean. But we have no notion about it at all. We're too distracted with this, with the attachment. And so, temporarily, the world does rearrange itself to suit our attachment, and we say, yay, great, my team won. But hang on, it'll change. You're going to be depressed tomorrow. Why do we do this? Why are we so hard on ourselves? And have you noticed all those negative feelings we have? You're jealous. Where does your jealousy come from? Look for the attachment underneath. Somebody is getting what you want and what you think you will not be happy without. You're anxious and frightened. You're getting paranoid. Your attachment has been threatened. See if you can understand that. I'll go slowly. You're getting angry. Somebody is likely to come in the way of your getting your attachment, or your keeping your attachment. Or else why would you be angry? Because you're convinced you're not going to be happy without this. You're not going to be happy without that. You've got craving. And so it goes on. All those negative feelings. Just scratch a bit on the surface, under the surface, probe under the surface, and the attachment will come to light. How about a little exercise? A couple of minutes. And it is this. Think of something or someone you are attached to. In other words, think of something or someone without which or without whom you think you are not going to be happy. It could be your job, your career, your profession, your friend, your money, or whatever. And say to it, him, her, I really do not need you to be happy. I'm only deluding myself into the belief that without you, I will not be happy. I'm only deluding myself into the belief that without you, I will not be happy. But I really don't need you for my happiness. I can be happy without you. You are not my happiness. You are not my joy. Boy, if it's a he or a her, he's not going to be too happy to hear that, you know. But go ahead, you could say it within the secrecy of your heart. Because you're making contact with the truth. You're smashing through a fantasy. Happiness is a state of non-illusion. Drop the illusion. Or you could try another exercise, if you'd rather do that. Think of a time you were heartbroken. You thought you'd never be happy again. Your husband died. Your wife died. Your best friend deserted you. You lost your money, or whatever. Think of the time you were a child and you didn't get what you want, or you lost what you had, and you said, I'll never be happy again. What happened? Time went on, and if you managed to pick up another attachment, if you managed to find somebody else you were attracted to, or something else that you were attracted to, what happened to the old attachment? You didn't really need it, did you, to be happy? That should have taught us, but we never learn. We're programmed, we're conditioned. Then I'll give you a few seconds to think, my, how liberating not to depend emotionally on anything. If you could get even 1 second's experience of that, you're breaking through your prison and getting a glimpse of the sky. Someday maybe you will fly. Okay, who wants to begin? Yes.
I was afraid to say this, but I talked to God. And I told him, I don't need him. My initial reaction was, this is so contrary to everything that I've been brought up. And yet I said, if he is the God that I think he ought to be, he is not going to imprison me. That's where I left
it. All right. If you think that unless you get God, you're not going to be happy, this God you're thinking of has nothing to do with God. You're thinking of a dream state, of a thing, of a person. You're thinking of your concept. And sometimes you have to get rid of God in order to find God. Lots of mystics tell us that. When you drop your attachments, when you drop your clinging, when you drop your baggage, think of the baggage we carry. If I use the word happiness, you know what most... See, the amount of times I catch myself doing this. Am I happy? Thinking, I got a great film coming up tonight, and I got... What's the future got to do with it? What has yesterday got to do with it? But we're constantly somewhere else. As somebody said, my favorite place is somewhere else. We're always somewhere else. But to attain the asceticism and the delight of being here, now, and when now goes, let it go, then we will know what reality is, what God is. The concept is a help, as I will tell you later. But we've always to beware lest it become a hindrance. Joe?
Tony, aren't you really programming the process of deprogramming ourselves?
That's not a bad comment at all. That's not a bad comment. I think I would be if I'd be telling you how to do it. All I'm saying is, be aware. Be aware. There are two things. There is programming and there is awareness. And the two are opposed to each other. Where awareness comes in, programming dies. When you're listening to me, as I said to you on the first day, if you're just swallowing everything I'm saying, you're getting programmed. And lots of people do, you know. I'm a great brainwasher. I really am. Well, that's not quite accurate. The way I speak very easily lends itself to gullible people getting brainwashed. That's more accurate. But if you're neither resisting what I'm saying nor swallowing, that's wonderful. You're open. You think, I'd like to take a look at that. Somebody else here? Yes. Someone you desire greatly? Yeah.
See, I didn't stop it. And the only way to get back to this is role playing. And is
the
role playing
help? Yes. You begin by doing it in fantasy and role playing. Yes. Yes, you'd better prepare your wife before you tell her this truth. Yes, I know. Isn't it amazing, though, that we have been so blinded by everything that we did not discover this basic truth? I remember how frightened I was to say this to an intimate friend of mine when I sensed it was true. I really don't need you. Period. For anything. I don't need you. I can be perfectly happy without you. Result, I enjoy your company thoroughly. There's no more anxiety, no more jealousy, no more possessiveness, no clinging. It is a delight to be with you. I'm enjoying you on a non-clinging basis. You're free. So am I. But this is like talking a foreign language to drug addicts. We've been drugged. We really have been. It took me many, many months to truly understand this. And mind you, I'm a Jesuit, brought up in the tradition of St. Ignatius, whose spiritual exercises are really all about this. And I'd missed the point. Because my culture and my society, not my religious society, but the society in India in general, society, you take it for granted. Jesus had friends. Wait a minute. What are we talking about? Because you know something? The moment you desire somebody in this way, namely, without you, I will not be happy, you cease to see that person. You're no longer objective. You're clinging. We begin to view people in terms of our attachment. If you're attached to appreciation, you know, I'm quite amused sometimes to see even seemingly objective people like therapists and spiritual directors, etc., say, great guy. You know, I really like him. And I find out later it's because he likes me that I like him. And anybody who attacks me, I don't like. Hey, so when someone's for you, he's okay. And when someone's against you, he's not okay. Then I look into myself and I find the same thing coming up every now and then. If you're attached to appreciation and praise, you're going to view people in terms of their threat to your attachment or their fostering your attachment. If you're a politician and you want to be voted in, how do you think you're going to look at people? How will your interest in people be guided? Who's the guy who's going to get me the votes? Who's the woman who's... And so it goes on. And if what you're interested in is in sex, how do you think you're going to look at men and women? If you're attached to sex. And if you're attached to power. And so on and on and on. That colors your view of human beings. An attachment destroys your capacity to love. What is love? Love is sensitivity. Love is consciousness. To give you an example, I'm sitting here listening to a symphony. If all I hear is the sound of the drums, I don't hear the symphony. What is a loving heart? A loving heart is one that is sensitive to the whole of life, to all persons. A heart that doesn't harden itself to any person or thing. But the moment you become attached, in my sense of the word, then you're blotting out many other things. You've got eyes only for the object of your attachment. You have ears only for the drum. The heart has got hardened. Moreover, it has got blinded because you no longer see the object of your attachment objectively. You cannot be objective anymore. Love entails clarity of perception, objectivity. There is nothing so clear-sighted as love. Then the heart remains soft and sensitive. But when you're hell-bent on getting this thing or that or the other, you become ruthless. You become hard. You become insensitive. But all you need is a few minutes' reflection to see this. How can you love people when you need people? You can only use them. When you need them emotionally. If I need you to make me happy, I cannot love you. I got to use you. I got to manipulate you. I got to find ways and means of winning you. I cannot leave you free. I can only love people when I have emptied my life of people. When I die to the need for people. Then I'm right in the desert. And in the beginning, it feels awful. It feels lonely. But if you can take it for a while, you'll suddenly discover that it isn't lonely at all. It is solitude. It is aloneness. And the desert begins to flower. And at last you know what love is, what God is, what reality is. But giving up the drug in the beginning can be tough unless you have a very keen understanding and you have suffered enough. It's a great thing to have suffered. Then you're sick of it. Make use of suffering to end suffering. But people suffer and they go on suffering, and that's why I said to you, the conflict within me sometimes between the role of spiritual director and therapist. As therapist, well, let's ease the suffering. All right. As the spiritual director in me says, let her suffer. She'll get sick of this way of relating to people. And she'll finally decide to break out of this prison of emotional dependence on anyone. Am I making sense? Big conflict at times. Shall I offer a palliative or remove the cancer? Not easy to decide, I'll tell you that. And when the cancer becomes painful enough, you're right, you're ready, if you have understanding. And you're ready to watch it. He says, first book, and he slams it on the table. Let him keep slamming it on the table. Don't pick the book up. All right. Lots of work to be done in the spiritual life. So much work. Spirituality is awareness. Awareness, 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 awareness. The day you begin to understand how you are really picking up things that have no connection with you at all. Like in the old days, and I guess my story is almost everyone's story, somebody was angry with me. Gee, there's something wrong with me. Because that's the way we've been drugged. That's the way we've been programmed by our parents. When mother got angry with you, she didn't say there's something wrong with me. She said there's something wrong with you, or I wouldn't be angry. Until I made the great discovery that if you are angry, darling, there's something wrong with you. So you'd better cope with your anger. Stay with it and cope with it. It's not mine. Now, whether there's something wrong with me or not, I'll examine independently of your anger. I'm not going to be influenced by your anger. And the funny thing is, when I can do this without feeling any negativity towards you, I can be quite objective towards myself too. Because only a very aware person can do this. Not pick up the guilt, not pick up the anger. You're having a tantrum, too bad. I don't feel the slightest desire to rescue you anymore. And I refuse to feel guilty. I must talk about guilt. It's like, I'm not going to hate myself for anything I have done. Because it gets you nowhere. That's what guilt is. I'm not going to give myself a bad feeling and whip myself for anything I have done, right or wrong. I'm ready to analyze it, to watch it, and say, well, if I did wrong, as I will show you presently, it was in unawareness. I was hypnotized. Nobody does wrong in awareness. And that's why theologians tell us, nicely, very beautifully said, that Jesus could do no wrong. Now that makes very good sense to me, because the enlightened person can do no wrong. What do you think? Was Jesus free? You mean he couldn't do wrong and he was free? Because he was free, he couldn't do wrong. Now, since you can do wrong, you're not free.
Because we're chained by something.
So you're not free. That's a pretty nice bind you've got yourself into, isn't it? Well, it's interesting. You know, if I'm sitting here and somebody comes up to me and says, "Are you free?" I say, "Yes, I'm free." "Well, here's this machine gun." He gives me a light machine gun. He says, "Why don't you mow all these people down?" I say, "Excuse me, I'm not free to do that. I got too much sensitivity to people to be able to do that. I cannot do it." Does that make sense to you? As soon as you have a sensitive heart, you cannot do this. You simply cannot do it. "Could you do it?" He says, "Yeah, I can. I can." All right, sit here. He sits here. And he says, "Wait a minute, this isn't freedom. This is a sickness. You need healing. This has far-reaching consequences." You know, I was telling you about this power of words and concepts. Your Mark Twain put it very nicely once when he said, "Cold," he says, "if the thermometer had been an inch longer, we would have frozen to death." That's pretty accurately put, you know. We do freeze to death on words. It's like, it's not the cold outside that matters, but the thermometer. It's not reality that matters, but what you're saying to yourself. You know, they told me a lovely one about a guy in Finland. You know, when they were drawing up the Russian-Finland border, there was a farmer who had to decide whether he wanted to be in Finland or Russia as they were drawing the boundary line. So after a long time, he said he wanted to be in Finland. And he didn't want to offend the Russian officials, who came up to him and demanded to know, why did he want to be in Finland? And the guy says, "You know, it has always been my desire to live in Mother Russia. But at my age, I wouldn't be able to survive another Russian winter. So I want to be in Finland." That brings it out very well, doesn't it? It's only a word. It's only a concept. But it isn't. Not for human beings. Not for crazy human beings. There was a man who once attacked a guru, the master, for claiming this. That human beings were mostly reacting to words, not to reality. As I explained to you this morning, the governor, a beggar, an Indian, an American, the cardinal, archbishop, the Pope, Mother Teresa. I wonder how many would be capable of seeing Mother Teresa. Or would they be seeing what they heard about her? Or would they be seeing what they're expecting? So we're frequently not looking at reality. We're almost never looking at reality. So this master was attempting to explain to them how human beings react to words. They feed on words. They live on words. They're perishing because they're living on words, not on reality. They're not getting nourished on reality. So one of the men stood up there and protested. He said, "I don't agree that words have all that effect on us." And the master said, "Sit down, you son of a bitch." And the man went livid with rage. He said, "You call yourself an enlightened person, you call yourself a master, you ought to be ashamed of you," and so on and on for a couple of minutes. And the master said, "Pardon me, sir, I just got carried away. I really beg your pardon. Pardon me, that was a lapse. I'm sorry." So the man calmed down. And the master said, "It took just a few words to get a whole tempest within you and a few words to calm you down, didn't it?" Words, 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 words. Who will liberate us from words? How valuable they are. How imprisoning if they're not used properly. Awareness your conditioning drops automatically. That depends on the degree of your awareness. Sometimes it's greater, sometimes it's less. But remember that little exercise I gave you yesterday when I said, don't identify with the feeling? The feeling will go on in the beginning. But as you disidentify, the intensity will diminish. And there are times when you get a flash of awareness, and in that flash, it drops altogether. So there are degrees of awareness, and we move into that. And sometimes we have more, and sometimes we have less. Towards the end of this session, I hope to give you, or the beginning of the next one, I hope to give you a little exercise to show you the difference between knowledge and awareness, between information and awareness. I said, one cannot do evil in awareness. One can do evil in knowledge or information. You know that this thing is bad, but you're really not aware. Father, forgive them because they do not know. They're not aware of what they are doing. I am the greatest of sinners, for I persecuted the Church of Christ. But friends, I did it unawares. If they had been aware that they were crucifying the Lord of glory, they would never have done so. A time will come when they will persecute you and they will think they're doing a service to God. What do you know? Thomas Aquinas puts it so nicely. He says, every time someone sins, they're sinning under the guise of good. They're blinding themselves. They're seeing something as good, even though they know it is bad. They're telling themselves in some way. They're rationalizing because they're seeking something as good under the pretext of good. But more about that when we talk of freedom. Anyone else? Yes.
It's very freeing to become aware of the image of driving in traffic, and you're maintaining a steady rate and lots of turns are blowing and they're getting four-letter words and et cetera. And I find it very difficult to maintain the serenity in the midst of that. Are you saying that by beginning the process of awareness, eventually that nervousness will dissipate and that the peace will be? That's my big search.
Did you pick up your attachment there? Your attachment to calm and peace. You're saying, unless I'm peaceful, I won't be happy. Did it ever occur to you, you could be happy in your tension? Before enlightenment, I used to be depressed. After enlightenment, I continue to be depressed. You hit upon something there. You see, if you don't make a goal out of relaxation and sensitivity. You ever heard of these people who get tense trying to relax? Yes. They're making an effort to relax. Well, if one is tense, one observes one's tension. You will never understand yourself if you seek to change yourself. I'll be explaining that to you later when we talk about self-change. The harder you try to change yourself, the worse it gets. You are called upon to be aware. Get the feel of that telephone. Get the feel of the ring of the phone. The jarred nerves. Get the sensation of that. Get the sensation of the steering wheel in the car. In other words, come to reality. And leave the tension or the calmness to take care of itself. As a matter of fact, you will leave it to take care of yourself because you'll be too preoccupied or too occupied getting in touch with reality. See, this is what I mean, kind of step by step, and let whatever happens, happens. You know, the real change will come about in you when it is brought about not by your ego, but by reality. Awareness releases reality to change you. You change. In sensitivity, you change. In consciousness and awareness, you change. But you've got to experience this. Useless taking my word for it. But if you've got a plan, if your ego has drawn up a plan in its own cunning way and trying to push you into that, You'll meet with resistance. There'll be trouble. Who else? Pretty good questions. Yes. Yes. All right. The question is being awakened a growing process? At times you're awake, at times you go to sleep, etc. Do you pick up the mild anxiety behind that? You want to be awake, don't you? You want to find out if you're really awake or not. Now, that's part of asceticism. It doesn't matter. How strange that sounds in a culture and a society where we've been trained to achieve goals, get somewhere. There's nowhere to go. You know why? Because you're there already. The Japanese have a nice way of putting it. The day you cease to travel, you will arrive. Now, if your attitude were, I want to be aware. I want to be in touch with whatever is, and let whatever happens, happen. If I'm awake, fine. If I'm asleep, fine. But the moment you make a goal out of it, and you're attempting to get it, see, what's happening there is you're seeking ego glorification, ego promotion. You want the good feeling that you've made it. I got news for you. When you make it, you won't know. Your left hand won't know what your right hand is doing. Lord, when did we do this? We had no awareness. Charity is never so lovely as when one has no consciousness that one is practicing charity. You mean I helped you? I was just enjoying myself. I was just doing my dance. It helped you. That's wonderful. Congratulations to you. No credit to me. Because tell me, if you're giving Jesus the credit for all the good that happened to people when he spoke, hold on to your chairs now. Why aren't you blaming him for all the evil that happened to people when he spoke? If I had not come, they would not have sinned. Who's to blame?
They are to blame.
And when they benefited, who gets the credit? He. Hey, wait a minute. The rain that is exactly the same in its nature produces thorns in the marsh and flowers in the garden. That's up to you. So, when you attain, when you are aware, increasingly you will not be bothered about labels like awake or asleep. You know, I must say I cheated with all of you. I used it, to use an Ignatian phrase, getting in through your door, arousing your curiosity, and I'm sorry to say, your spiritual greed, but greed nonetheless. Say, let's come awake. It's going to be wonderful. Well, that's for starters. After a while, it doesn't matter. One is aware because one lives. The unaware life is not worth living. And you will leave change to take care of itself.